Phoenix voters have given Greg Stanton another four-year term as mayor and agreed to increase their sales taxes to pay for transportation projects, including an expanded light rail system. I'm Mark Brody. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk to Stanton about his plans for a second term and break down the results of all of yesterday's races. Arizona schools dealt with budget cuts during the recession, but the head of the state's technology council says reductions in one area could really hurt the state's economy. We'll ask him why. Arizona has a lot of transportation needs and a lot of ideas of how to make them happen. What tops the list and how many projects can the state realistically do? Plus, a new school at ASU looks at the interaction of and relationship between technology and society and will preview the Valley's fall theater season. That's all ahead on KJZZ's Here and Now after a check of this hour's news. Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, and today for Steve Goldstein. Later this hour, why cuts to career and technical education could hurt the state's economy and getting input on Arizona's transportation needs. But first, Phoenix voters last night re-elected Mayor Greg Stanton. Unofficial results show he won about 65% of the vote. Anna Brennan came in second with almost 29%. Matthew Jetty got less than 6% of the vote. In his victory speech last night, Stanton told supporters he's just getting started. Mayor Greg Stanton joins me now. Good morning, Mayor, and congratulations. Mayor Stanton, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Good morning. Congratulations, and thanks for being with us.
Happy to do it. It's a great day last night for myself, my family, and all of Phoenix. We decided to invest in ourselves.
So what for you is the top priority for the next 4 years? You got four more years in office. What do you most want to do?
Well, what I'm going to do for the next 4 years is exactly what I have done over the last 4 years, and that is to work to make Phoenix a more innovative economy, a more export-based economy. This is an increasingly competitive international economy that we are competing in, and we have to better position Phoenix, our current generation and future generations, to be able to compete in that economy. So that's why I've been so actively involved in making sure that Phoenix has made smart investments, like in the Cancer Center that just opened a couple weeks ago in downtown Phoenix. It's why we're working so hard to make the land near Mayo Clinic up in North Phoenix a dense employment center in biosciences and medical research and medical education. It's why we're working so hard to build an export-based economy by opening up Mexico City trade office and training our local businesses in how to export. It's why I made such a priority of investments in transportation, because we can't meet our goals as a city unless we're a great multimodal city, and we're moving in that direction. So I think Phoenix is moving forward in the right direction. I think we're going to take our rightful place as one of the leading economic cities in the United States of America. We just got to keep going down the right path. That's exactly what I'm going to be working on for the next 4 years.
Well, let's talk about transportation. You were one of the top supporters of Proposition 104, which was approved last night by Phoenix voters. I'm curious how closely you think the results of your election and Prop 104 were connected.
I don't know. I'll let the political pundits decide that. All I know is I believe that Prop 104 was critically important to our future. Mary Peters, who was the chair of the committee that put it together, the former Secretary of Transportation under President Bush, he put together a great plan, a plan that really looked at the connection between transportation and education, looked at the connection between transportation and employment by getting people to the major employment centers within our valley. She understood the importance of investing more in dialerized services so that people with disabilities, or maybe they've reached an age where they don't feel comfortable driving a car, can still maintain mobility independence. She understood how important it was to build a more bikeable, walkable city. And she understood how important it was to do basic street repairs and maintenance that we have to do to upkeep. So it's a comprehensive plan. It's a big plan, as the opponents argued. They argued that it was a very, very big plan. I actually agree with that. And that's exactly why the citizens of Phoenix overwhelmingly support of that. So I'll let others do the political punditry and analysis. All I know is I worked my tail off to try to pass that thing, and I'm so happy that the people of Phoenix overwhelmingly supported not only myself for four more years as mayor of this great city, but also Proposition 104 and all the propositions that were on the ballot. We had a clean sweep last night, and it was a great night for Phoenix.
Between you and the other council members who are also all the incumbents were reelected, the city will essentially have the same elected leadership going forward. Do you think that's a good thing?
I say thank goodness. I mean, I have a talented group of council members that I have opportunity to work with. I endorsed every single member of that city council for re-election. Look, we've got smart, challenging people from a diverse political positions. As you know, we have hotly debated issues at the city, and I love it. That's exactly what it should be. If we're going to put forward something as comprehensive as Proposition 104, which had opposition even among my own council members, it should be something that is hotly debated. And we did have a great debate in this community, and obviously the voters, thank goodness, saw it the way that I saw it and the way the majority of the council saw it. But I'm so lucky to have a talented group of council members, and I look forward to working with them for the next 4 years.
What do you see as the biggest challenge or challenges that your city will face in the next 4 years?
Well, I think we've seen it most recently. The article written by the Business Journal talking about the perception that we don't support education to the level that we need to, and how it's hurting us in our economic development efforts. We got to come to terms with that. And though funding education isn't a city issue, supporting education absolutely is a city issue. So we have to come together, both as city, the governor's office, the state legislature, the business community, the nonprofit community, and we've got to do a better job in that regard. That's one issue, is continuing to advance education, because we won't achieve our goals from an economic development perspective, building an advanced, innovative, export-based economy, unless we do more to support education. And second is water. Water's a huge issue in our community. And though Phoenix has done a good job of planning, we cannot rest on our laurels. We have to make sure that we're doing a better job of water conservation, water planning, and protecting our water rights. So those are some big issues that we'll be facing moving forward into the very near future. And I'm sure glad I was elected last night, because I can't wait to roll up my sleeves. I've already started at 8 a.m. this morning. Let's get right back to work.
You've talked a lot about, and Prop 104 supporters talked a lot about, changes sort of within the urban core, the downtown core of the city. What do you have planned, or what do you think the city should be doing for other parts? I don't want to say far flung, but the not urban downtown core of the city.
Well, first off, some of the opponents of Proposition 104 tried to leave the false impression that Proposition 104 was only about the center core. The reality is that we've already invested in the center core. Transit 2000 put a great 20 plus mile line from Christown Mall through the central part of the city to downtown, out to Tempe, and then out to Mesa. What Proposition 104 does exactly what you're describing. It brings transportation to other parts of the city. Because of what happened last night and the overwhelming support of the people of Phoenix, we're now going to get light rail to South Phoenix, which should have had it a long time ago. We're going to get light rail to Maryvale and West Phoenix, and up to Northwest Phoenix, over to Grand Canyon University, and then up to ASU West. We're going to get it to Northeast Phoenix and Paradise Valley Mall. And other parts of the city are going to massively benefit from Prop 104 with improved bus service, bus rapid transit, dial-a-ride services, street improvements, building a more bikeable community. All of that is going to benefit the people of this community. Some of the opponents tried to leave the false impression that public transportation only benefits a small number of people. They are wrong. What the people said last night is that even if I don't personally utilize light rail, it's a darn good thing that we have it in Phoenix, because we know it improves educational opportunities for young people. We know it improves people's access to employment and employment centers. It's good for our city, and therefore I'm going to vote for it even if I don't happen to utilize it myself. And even if I don't utilize it, I know someone with a disability that does. Maybe a father or mother that's getting to the point where they don't want to continue to drive. They're going to utilize it. You get the point. I think the opponents were wrong to try to point out that people who don't utilize public transportation don't understand how important it is to a city to have great public transportation.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton, fresh off his reelection in yesterday's election. Mayor Stanton, thank you.
Always a pleasure, and look forward to coming on in the near future.
All right, very good. For more on Phoenix's election and what all of the results mean, we now turn to two observers of city government and politics who know the answers. Wes Gullett is a former mayoral candidate and CEO of OH Strategic in Phoenix. Chip Scutari is co-founder of Scutari and Sislak Public Relations. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to get your general impressions of the results overall first. And Wes, let me start with you. What stood out to you?
Well, it wasn't a big surprise. I thought that it would go about the way it did. I was a little surprised that Proposition 104 didn't get as a better, closer to what Greg's total was. That kind of surprised me.
Chip, what about you?
I think the night was dominated by the Prop 104 win because You know, you're talking about a $31 billion, you know, investment over 35 years. And I think it represents a kind of a paradigm shift from 10, 15 years ago. I remember as a young reporter when I almost full head of hair and I covered a transit election in September of 97 in Scottsdale's half-cent sales tax, and it got torpedoed 60-40. It lost. And now I think because of the success of not just light rail but buses, you know, this is a huge victory, not just light rail, but we're talking bike lanes, fixing roads, you know, more bus service. I think when we look back on this night 20 years from now, it's going to be one of the most far-reaching, consequential elections in Phoenix history. I really do.
Mayor Stanton said that political pundits should answer this question, so I'll put it to you since he wouldn't touch it. How closely do you each think his reelection and Prop 104's passing were? I mean, did voters see them as one and the same, or were they two separate issues to voters?
Well, in my mailbox, they seem to be very similar. I got all the mail for both seemingly at the same time. I think the size of it, how big the project was, that probably peeled off some more. Mayor Stanton obviously didn't have significant opposition in his race, so he did better. But I thought that was an interesting that there was a 10-point gap.
You know, my take on it was it almost was like, you know, not only Mayor Stanton, but the other council members who were on the ballot, even, you know, Danny Valenzuela, who had minor opposition, that was a fait accompli. It was all about the transit election. And it seemed to me that, you know, Mayor Stanton focused the vast majority of his energy on that proposition, getting that initiative to pass, because a lot of my Phoenix friends said, "Guy, we got 10 or 12 mail pieces for, you know, Prop 104 and the transit, but not a lot from Mayor Stanton, even Democrats." So I think, you know, they're tied and they're linked, and he was definitely the face and the voice of the campaign. But I think people saw them as separate issues at the end of the day.
Wes, why didn't Mayor Stanton have, as you say, more significant opposition? I mean, this is a big city. This is not, you know, this is not some small town. This is the sixth biggest city in the country.
Well, I think that when you have a big war chest, you've done a good job, you haven't had a major mistake, that people see it as, you know, this is a really tough race. And so they're not going to take on an incumbent. So you didn't have significant opposition. If in 4 years, you're going to see a much different situation where you'll have several people running for mayor again, like 4 years ago.
And I think Wes can attest this because of his firsthand knowledge of it. Running for office, especially for mayor of the sixth largest city for an uncontested seat, is a lot of work. And I hear, you know, I'll be at different meetings and people are like, "Oh, I can't believe there's not more people running." And I say, "Are you going to run?" And they're like, "Heck no." You know, so it's a big endeavor for you and your family, for your life. There's a lot of stress, I'm sure, for that Wes went through. So I think that it's not an easy proposition running for the mayor of Phoenix, especially someone who's an incumbent who's pretty popular.
It's not that hard. It's really super fun.
Do we see a ticket in 4 years, the Gullet's Qatari ticket here coming?
Knocking on all those doors.
So I have to admit that I don't spend all of my spare time just randomly driving around the streets of Phoenix. But in the time over the last several weeks that I was driving through, I honestly don't think I saw one sign for Mayor Stanton up. Did either of you see any? Did he even bother putting up signs in this election?
I don't think he put up any signs.
I think that goes to my point where he was really focusing a vast majority of his energy towards Prop 104 and transportation and not his reelect. Because let's face it, the two people who were challenging him weren't world beaters. So he, you know, it was a pretty, you know, it was a no-brainer that he was going to win reelection.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, speaking with Chip Scutari and Wes Gullet, breaking down the results of yesterday's Phoenix elections. We've talked about Prop 104, but Wes, why do you think it passed with the margin that it did? I mean, it wasn't maybe as close as you thought it would, didn't have as quite a big a spread as you thought it would be, but it still passed fairly easily.
Yeah, well, I think people in Phoenix, I think the mayor was absolutely right when he said people are willing to invest in the city. I think that the citizens and the voters who voted in this election, which are very different than the total citizenry of the city because turnout is pretty small in this election, but the voters who voted said, "We're going to invest this money. We're going to take this money. We're going to invest it in what we think is really important for a big urban area, and that's to have good transportation." And so you know, you, when you break it down, I used to joke that the people who vote in the city of Phoenix elections are the city employees and their blood relatives. But those people get it. You know, they vote and they're going to vote for this.
Chip, what do you think?
I think that this election could be, you know, the transportation might be a catalyst for other parts of the valley. Wes mentions that, you know, this is, you know, a good political climate for light rail and mass transit because it's Phoenix. There's a lot of, you know, hardcore Democrat voters. But I think this could be seen. I know the city of Chandler now is studying the possibility of having rail from Mesa's Fiesta Mall area into Chandler, you know, maybe in southern Scottsdale. This election could be the catalyst. Now, those elections will be more difficult because they're in more Republican-friendly areas. They put it on the ballot in August on purpose, you know, along with Mayor Stanton's reelect and the other council members' reelection, and they knew who to target for their voters, and they got it done.
I know this will be a surprise, but I hate to ask a cynical question.
How dare you?
I know, a journalist asking a cynical question. What are the odds? Were the results in Prop 104 about more than just the fact that the pro side had a ton more money than the anti side? I mean, were people just bombarded with messages, or do they really believe in what Prop 104 has to offer and could lead for the city?
You know, it depends on who you ask. I say that they did a really good job of building a coalition of not, you know, bike enthusiasts, you know, people who ride rail, seniors, millennials, and they raised a lot of money. You know, we always hear the losing side on any election, whether it's candidate or an issue campaign, said, well, I would have won if I wasn't outspent 15-1, you know, but there's a reason why you're outspent. People are passionate. They want to get it done. And, you know, as Wes knows, because he's in the economic development space as well as we, that a lot of, you know, economic development will be based along the light rail. And there's arguments about how much of an impact it has. But in that economic development space, people are really, really happy this passed.
Well, and I think the key, I think the best argument that they had was the education thing, moving students. And people can see that. They know that light rail works for education. And I drive by the Central High School stop every single day. And that is it is a remarkable thing to see. Those kids, you know, on that on the light rail, you go downtown, you're connecting downtown campus to Main. It's that's really important. This idea that we're going to go to ASU West, connecting ASU West with Main, is a really important thing. It helps the community college system. It moves people around, and it helps the kids in high school. So, you know, I think that was really powerful.
Prop 104, obviously not the only ballot measure that voters approved yesterday. There was the general plan also that that voters passed. Do you get the sense that voters have a sense of what's in the general plan and what a general plan even is?
I was the chairman of the Planning and Zoning Commission and was on the commission
so you better
for
hope
five
so,
years. I didn't understand what was in it, so I doubt if many people did. But it was necessary to get done. I think Mo Stein did a wonderful job in chairing that and driving that. And my hat's off to him for getting it passed, because it's really important to have a general plan that's workable.
Yeah, I probably know less about the general plan than Wes does, but I do know that one of the things that Phoenix citizens wanted in a general plan is connectivity, which is what Prop 104 is supposed to be all about. So, you know, I wasn't up doing a thesis paper on the general plan last night. But
why not?
I was doing other things. Okay. I had to take care of my kids. You
know. Also, Phoenix will now be able to make electronic payments, which I have to be honest, I didn't know that the city couldn't do that before, but apparently it couldn't, so now it can. And talking about sort of the theme of some of these ballot measures was, I guess you could almost call it like Phoenix going forward, like let's try to bring the city into the 21st century and expand on that and be ready for whatever's next. Is that a fair assessment of what was on the ballot?
Yeah, I think they were very strategic in what they put on the ballot, too. I think they wanted to make sure that there were things that led to a positive vote that would help a positive vote for Prop 104. So if you got done marking yes, 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 which 75% of the people did, you got down to 104, you were more likely to say yes to that one, too.
You know, and these getting these other ballot propositions passed is a big deal, because in my adopted hometown of Scottsdale, we can't even pass a bond measure. So for Phoenix to get a $31 billion investment into mass transit, have all these other propositions pass, you know, kudos to the city employees and everyone who worked on these, because they're not as easy as they seem to get done.
The mayor and the city council will be exactly the same going forward, at least for the next couple of years, until another set of city council members is up for re-election. I asked Mayor Stanton this. I'll ask you guys this. Is that a good thing, that basically the elected leadership of the city will stay exactly the same?
Yeah, if you like what's going on in Phoenix, I think it's a positive thing. You know, the city elections, I argued strenuously, and I have continued to argue strenuously, that you move the election to the real election day instead of having it in this odd-numbered year and all that stuff, because I think that creates more opportunity for elections. It gets more people to vote, gets more people to participate. I think you have more people engaged in the process. But you know, we get what we get in these off-year elections.
I disagree with my esteemed colleague here, because I believe in local control, that cities and towns should be able to call their elections whenever. And because,
well, I think that if local control, that people of Phoenix ought to move it.
Oh, yeah, sure. But, I mean, my point is, when city council races are on a presidential ballot or there's a local issue, it usually gets shoved aside. There's no
ballot fatigue.
Yeah. There's undercounting of ballots. So we can agree to disagree on that.
But, I mean, is it a tough sell to say, okay, we're going to have the same people, but we're also trying to look forward? I mean, it's sort of a vote for the status quo, but also a vote for something new and shiny and exciting down the road.
You have to remember that compared to Congress, in the House of Representatives and the Senate, where guys and gals stay there for decades. You know, Danny Valenzuela, Kate Gallego, these people are pretty new to politics. You know, Thelda Williams, a political veteran. But when you look about, at the other council members, Bill Gates, they're relatively new. So I think maybe they've gotten their sea legs now, and they can work on some big issues moving forward. And, I think 2 or 3 years from now, we'll be focused on who's running for mayor.
So what do each of you think is the biggest challenge, or are the biggest challenges the city will be facing in the next couple of years? Wes, I'll start with you.
Well, I think the mayor was right. We've got to have economic growth. We've got to get Phoenix in that top tier of places that people want to bring their business to. They want to grow their business. We need to have a workforce that's educated. We have to invest in higher education, community colleges, and we've got to make sure that we've got a strong workforce in the city of Phoenix.
How much of that is really something that the city can affect, though?
Well, the city can, it's all about the atmosphere, right? And the city can do a big job of making sure that when you come, this is a great city. You come to this city, when I come home from San Francisco or someplace like that, I'm so happy to be home. It's clean, it's safe, it's a good place to live and do business. And we've got to be able to project that.
Yeah, I would agree with Wes. I mean, the two interconnected issues of education and economic development are huge. You know, it'd be easy to say the budget deficit, but that's a symptom of, our education system, maybe failing in certain areas, lack of economic development and high-quality jobs. And I think city mayor and, city council members can have a huge impact on that. I think, we've seen in recent polling that education now is the number one issue in Arizona, more so than border security or illegal immigration. And I think that will be the tenor of the next election moving into next November.
Well, to Wes's point, I mean, the city has to create the atmosphere. So how much of that is basically a sales job of letting people know, be they potential residents or potential employers, that, hey, this is what's going on here?
I think this victory for Prop 104 is huge because, I come from the East Coast. A lot of my friends think it's all desert out here, and they know about Sheriff Joe and, the character of the state. And with us putting those dollars into light rail, it adds a level of sophistication of, cosmopolitan place for, restaurants, foodies, great jobs along light rail. I think that will help change the perception, which isn't accurate, but it will help change that negative perception that exists in some quarters.
That's Chip Scutari, co-founder of Scutari and Sislak Public Relations. I've also been joined by Wes Gullett. He's CEO of OH Strategic in Phoenix, also a former mayoral candidate. We've been breaking down the results of last night's Phoenix elections. Gentlemen, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And still to come, finding answers to Arizona's transportation problems and getting students ready for work. That's ahead as Here and Now continues.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, unveiling the 2015 XV Crosstrek, a 34 mpg compact utility vehicle for that go-anywhere spirit. Shop Subaru.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. We'll have the latest international news from the BBC on NewsHour. That's coming up today at 1. Taking a look at the Valley freeways right now, southbound on the State Route 51, the crash at the I-10 202 mini stack is now clear, but watch out for some vehicles on the right that are still there. And on the US 60 freeway eastbound, there's a car on fire that's blocking the Stapley Road exit ramp. You can try exiting the freeway at Mesa Drive or Gilbert Road instead. Around the state right now, cloudy skies and 68 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 93 in Casa Grande, sunny and 88 in Tucson, mostly sunny 102 degrees in Yuma. Right now in Phoenix with 32% relative humidity, it's mostly sunny and 96 degrees at KJZZ at 1131.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Transportation is one of those issues that seems to be a pretty constant topic of discussion in Arizona, be it public transit, freeways, bridges, or any number of other issues. The Arizona Town Hall took this issue on earlier this year, and this morning, officials with the group presented some of the group's recommendations. Tara Jackson is president of Arizona Town Hall, and she joins me now. Hi, Tara.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
So what was an event like the one you had this morning? What's the goal? What are you trying to achieve with that?
So the event that we had this morning was one of our community outreach programs. We held that in the East Valley. And the goal of that is to share the recommendations from the 3.5-day town hall that we held on transportation, and then to get additional public input to find out what action plans and how we can implement them even on a community basis.
How different are the recommendations you get from people in different parts of the valley and different parts of the state?
Well, I've been doing this for 9 years, and it really is interesting for me to see when I do the 20-plus programs on a topic throughout the state and compare them to the statewide gathering. There are always trends and remarkable consistencies across the jurisdictions in the state. In transportation, there really are some differences on rural Arizona versus Maricopa County, especially given, you know, the election results this morning.
Do you get different results, West Valley, East Valley, any parts of the Phoenix area? Or is there kind of a consensus about what folks here want?
There really is a consensus overall. I think the biggest disparities in what action items need to be taken tend to be between the rural areas and the urban areas.
Funding is clearly an issue, and one of the recommendations that Arizona Town Hall put forward was increasing the gas tax, which would help pay for transportation infrastructure, roads, bridges, things like that. This is an idea that it seems to me, and I'm guessing I'm not alone, would be a really tough sell at the state legislature. So how do you go about trying to raise money and get money allocated for some of these projects? Because these projects can be quite expensive.
Well, it's almost an impossible task at the state legislature right now. And in fact, that was one of the discrepancies that was talked about in the East Valley today between what just happened in Maricopa County and then there's the rest of the state. For those that don't know, the money for the rest of the state is really not there at all. In fact, just within this last week, Arizona's rural roads were ranked, I think, 7th most dangerous in the country. It really showcases the disparity and difference once you get outside of Maricopa County.
So how do you go about trying to get money? I mean, where are the other pots that you can, you know, dig from to pay for these things?
Well, that's the question of the day. So I can share with you some of the ideas. First of all, the general public sentiment. If you were to look at the town hall recommendations, which are on our website, you would see that people from around the state agreed we need more funding for transportation, and we need it for all the reasons your earlier guest spoke about, and that is that it's directly tied to the economies. How to get it when we have a legislature and governor that have made it not only very clear that there will be no new taxes, but now, of course, we have education as a really important critical funding source. So at the meeting I had this morning, there were some really interesting novel ways to look at that, including from Senator Bob Worsley, who currently chairs the Transportation Committee. And there might be some ways to look at ways of getting funding with the gas tax, especially right now gas is at an all-time low. If you're going to try to bring the funding up to the levels needed, this is the time to do it, but it is politically extremely challenging.
Given the results of Prop 104 in Phoenix, is it at least tempting to try to put something on the ballot and ask voters to raise some kind of revenue to pay for these projects?
Well, what it does show is that there is some public support and understanding for the investment in transportation. And so that maybe it is time to take the discussion beyond Maricopa County and say, well, once we get outside of Maricopa County's borders, we still need to have transportation throughout the rest of the state. And so to connect those two. And in fact, your cynical question you asked your guests earlier, I would take a different response to that. So of course, I'm looking at all these issues from someone on a statewide basis, non-political. And what I see repeatedly, including in transportation, is the general population throughout the state, regardless of political party, is willing to invest in projects that where they see the return on investment, including education and transportation. The disparity is what happens at the state legislature.
So do transportation advocates need to maybe do a better job of linking transportation needs, education needs, economic development needs to make that case more clear to people?
Absolutely. I think a lot of just your average working person doesn't understand for our future economy how integral transportation investment is. And so it's about telling that story about connecting those needs for the future economic future of Arizona.
Is there any hope that new technology could provide easier or cheaper alternatives to do some of the projects, building materials or something else, that where you could get the stuff done that needs to be done, but maybe it would cost a little bit less?
Absolutely. There's a lot of discussion about new technology. But where I've heard most of it is not about cheaper building materials. Certainly, I'm sure that's an area to explore. It's been more about how to use technology so that people are maybe driving on off-peak hours. You make it more efficient. You have a lot of discussion about cars that drive themselves and how that will make our roads more efficient and therefore make it cheaper. There is one flip side to that, though, and that is that we get our funds for state highways from the gas tax. New technology that almost everyone wants to support is about cars that are more fuel efficient. So ironically, as our cars become more fuel efficient, if we don't change the way we get income to support our highways, we'll have less money for the same amount of road usage.
Tara Jackson is president of Arizona Town Hall, talking about transportation issues brought up by attendees of the town hall. Tara, thank you.
Thank you.
Talks broke down yesterday in the effort to come to an agreement on how to get schools more than $1 billion they say the state owes them. It's the latest in a lawsuit, which the schools won, which argued lawmakers shorted the money during the recession. While most, if not all, areas of public education have been affected by spending cuts made during the Great Recession, my next guest says Joint Technical Education Districts, or JTEDs, need more investment now that the economy is turning around. Steve Zylstra is president and CEO of the Arizona Technology Council. Steve, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what prompted you to write this piece? It ran in the Republic. It talked about how cuts to career and technical education may really hurt the state's economy.
Well, I represent 825 technology companies across Arizona. And the kind of talent that's becoming more and more scarce and difficult to find are positions like machinists and welders and in the IT industry, technicians. And vocational education, we now call it career and technical education, provides the kind of education and training that these students need in order to hit the ground running when they get to the workplace. So this program has been drastically cut, and according to the officials I've talked to in the CTE programs, the cut of $29 million will result in about 30 teachers being cut this year, and then it's sort of a spiral effect. And after a number of years, the program will literally go away. And that's going to have a dramatic impact on our ability to find the kind of workers we need in today's innovation economy.
Have the cuts to these programs been disproportionate to the rest of the cuts that education programs have seen around the state?
Well, I haven't done that math, but I can tell you that when this program came to fruition in 2010, the funding level was $94 million. And there was a cut a couple of years ago. They cut the freshman program support. And this year's projected budget will be $41 million of that original $94 million. Just a dramatic cut, certainly more than 50%.
What is the relationship between these classes and the students who take them and employers and jobs in this state?
Well, that's the key issue. These programs are designed to provide, you know, the workers of the future. There's a direct tie between the employers, the industry, and the students that are being produced in these JTED in the JTED environment. And so it's really tying the educational opportunity to the demand and the marketplace and providing the workers of the future.
Is the concern that there won't, that if these programs continue to get cut and students can't take the classes and get the training, that there won't be enough qualified workers for the jobs that are here, or that we won't be able to bring in new employers because there won't be those kinds of workers here?
It's both. As the economy heats up, there's greater demand for this kind of talent. As we continue to be successful at attracting new companies to the region, it puts even more pressure on the demand side. And, you know, the program has proven itself. Believe it or not, the graduation rate of students that go through a successful CTE JTET program is 98%. Which is incredible considering that the state average is only 76%. So the program has really proven itself. And even with taking only two JTED CTE courses, that's enough to enhance the graduation rate.
We hear a lot about how employers coming, you know, looking at where to relocate or where to expand, look at education systems. Do you get the sense that they're looking specifically at these CTE programs and whether or not Arizona has a robust JTED-style program or not?
I do. Every other state in the country is enhancing their investment in these kinds of programs because this is what we might call the middle skill level. You know, these could be auto mechanics, welders, machinists, that kind of opportunity. And, you know, those are critical to any particularly manufacturing environment and increasingly in the tech sector on the IT side. So I think it's a competitiveness issue. If we don't provide the funding for this kind of program, we're not going to have the workers we need to continue to grow our economy.
Are there particular industries that you think will be most affected by this?
Well, manufacturing for sure. These are the kind of jobs that are nice paying jobs, and companies like Raytheon and Honeywell and Boeing and companies like that manufacture stuff, even Intel, have the need for these kind of middle skill jobs. And so, as I said, it really will affect our ability to compete.
Do you think that either the plan that Governor Ducey has put forward or the plan just from yesterday that Senate President Andy Biggs and House Speaker David Gowan put out about getting more money to education, does that help the situation at all?
Well, I applaud and embrace any initiative to enhance funding for K through 12 education and even post-secondary education. It's a critical element to producing the kind of workforce that we need in an innovation economy. And without proper investment in education, without the kind of resources that are necessary, Arizona just won't compete.
Do you have any level of optimism that these programs will be getting some increased money or even restored to where they were before the recession?
I'm hopeful. I know that a lot of legislators that I've talked to care deeply. They had to make some hard decisions last year in order to balance the budget. The state is doing a little bit better. The revenues have been higher than what were expected. So I'm hoping that they find their way to make the proper investments in education, which is our future.
Steve Zylstra is president and CEO of the Arizona Technology Council. Steve, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And just ahead, the interaction between technology and society, and get ready for jazz hands. That's as KJZZ's Here and Now continues.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and streaming at kjzz.org. We'll see partly sunny skies today in the valley, a slight chance for some showers, the high expected to reach 105 degrees. It'll be partly sunny again tomorrow. That chance of rain continues with the high rising to 106. In valley traffic right now on the eastbound US 60 freeway, the vehicle fire on the exit ramp at Stapley Road has now been put out and the ramp is back open. Here and Now from Boston is coming up today at 12. China's stock markets have been turbulent lately. How insulated is the U.S. economy from China's troubles? And firefighters in Washington state are stretched so thin they're bringing in civilians to help. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. It's mostly sunny right now in Phoenix and 96 degrees at 11:46.
Good morning. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Technology is changing quickly, and its impact on society can sometimes be unpredictable. A new school at ASU aims to look at the relationship between tech and society. It's called the School for the Future of Innovation in Society. Dave Gustin is its director, and he joins me now. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
So what's this thing all about?
So we know that science and technology advance rapidly. We know that a lot of good things that we get in the world come from innovation that's grounded in the creation of new knowledge. But scientific progress and social progress are not necessarily the same thing. And it takes a lot more than simply a good idea or even a good idea manifest in an invention to create an innovation that's good for the rest of society. And so what the school is going to focus on significantly is that intersection where the social and the technical come together in the hopes of creating a way that we can think about the futures that we're all going to inhabit in a more constructive way.
Do you think that technology moves more quickly than society is ready for it to be?
I don't like to think that technology is moving any more quickly or less quickly than society, because technology is something that people do. We make technologies. And so it's not moving any faster than the people who make it move, but it might be moving in different directions or according to different values that might be more constructive for everybody.
So what are some of the kinds of things that your students will be learning about? Like what specifically are you going to be teaching?
So we'll have students who are getting doctoral degrees who will be doing research on this in the future. People who have worked in that program have studied things ranging from the transition of energy to solar energy in North Africa, to things like the smart city and the implications of wiring and connecting everything to the internet, everything ranging from human beings to buildings to transportation nodes. We have students who are getting master's degrees who will be filling these kinds of transactional positions, communicating between technical professionals and social and political professionals, both locally, domestically, and even internationally. And ultimately, we will be creating an undergraduate degree for students, not just to get a taste of this kind of work, but to prepare themselves for careers in innovative sectors where the social and the technical are meshing up.
It kind of sounds like you're going to be working with students who ultimately want to be some kind of like a liaison between the technology world and sort of the rest of us who aren't in that technology world to sort of get us to figure out how we can all live together happily.
Well, that's certainly going to be one of the kinds of careers that the students that we'll work with will prepare for. I think that, you know, just like other liberal arts and sciences, students will be preparing for other professional careers. Students who start in the science, technology, engineering, mathematics, the STEM disciplines, who might find that that's not particularly for them, I think that those are going to be great students for us, because that concept of a pipeline – that takes students from from math and science in high school to a PhD in science or engineering is really a bad concept because people think about it as leaking, and that leak is a loss. Well, when those people who are scientifically and technically informed go into other kinds of careers, that helps build an innovative capacity throughout society. And so I think we're going to take advantage of that as well.
What role will ethical discussions play in your school? Because a lot of these technologies are terrific, except they have some ethical considerations that need to be looked at.
So one of our master's degree programs actually pays attention to ethics. It's called Applied Ethics in the Professions, and it focuses on the one hand on bioethics and also on science and technology and engineering ethics. And these are important questions because, look, if people have a right to participate in political decision making and we think we want democratic politics and small d democratic politics and legislatures and voting and so on to help make the laws that we live with, it's somewhat pretty much the case that the innovations that we live with operate on our lives a lot like those laws. There are things that constrain us. There are things that enable us. There are things that we have to do in response to those technologies. And if we believe that we want democratic representation with respect to making our laws, we might want to think about democratic representation with respect to the things that we create, to the innovations that we create. And therefore, that sort of political and ethical aspect is part of what it means to create an innovation that works well in society.
Do you think that the relationship between society and technology has changed, or just the types of technologies that we're talking about?
The types of technologies are, in fact, changing, and this is one of the real intellectual questions at the root of this. How new is new? So is there something that's new in this particular technology that requires different kinds of attention or different kinds of structures to deal with it or new laws to deal with it? And I think one of the things that we'll train our students in trying to understand is that a lot of these technologies have precedent. There are technologies that were like them that came before. There will be technologies different for them that will come in the future. Even those older legacy technologies had amazing impact, some of which were understood, some of which weren't, some of which changed the way we worked and slept and dealt with our families and understood how we set our watches and worked with colleagues, and some of the new technologies may do that too. But understanding the novel parts of them doesn't necessarily mean that we need new structures. But it's also the case that we don't deal with some of those old technologies very well either. Nuclear technology, great example of a legacy technology that we still haven't grappled with, even though we've been working on it for 50 years.
So do you think that going forward then, even though the technologies will change and some things will get smaller and some things might get bigger, sort of their role in our lives maybe will stay the same as you say they have been?
The role in our lives, I think, will continue to expand to the extent that the economy is grounded in knowledge-based innovation. And that means also that for the students that will be training and coming in contact with at ASU, you know, the future really belongs to everybody. And in that sense, the accessibility to the work that we do, you know, we really want it to match the university's overall goal of creating an accessible higher education environment because everybody has a stake in this future.
Dave Gostin is the director of ASU's new School for the Future of Innovation in Society. Dave, thank you.
Thank you.
Many of the traditional signs of fall are upon us. School's back in session. Temperatures should, at least theoretically, start coming down a bit, and the new theater season will be starting up soon. To get a preview, I'm joined by Robert Pala, theater critic for Phoenix New Times. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Mark.
So what are you looking for as far as fall theater coming up in the Phoenix area in the next couple of months?
This is a really good season for people who like musicals.
Do you like musicals?
Well.
are you one of those people?
No, I'm not. I'm not supposed to talk about that in polite circles. But no, I'm not a fan of the form. However, a good musical done well is just that. But everybody's doing musicals this year. In fact, Phoenix Theater is doing an entire season of them, which, you know, is good news for some and bad news for others. But everybody's got musicals on their schedule this year. Even Arizona Theater Company, which doesn't always do more than one, is doing another Hershey Felder show this year. This time he's Irving Berlin, you know, different character each time. They're doing a Stephen Schwartz review. Schwartz took all of his greatest hits and some of his unknown things and put them together into a piece called Snapshots, which is subtitled A Musical Scrapbook. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, Phoenix Theater is really the winner as far as musicals go. They're doing Chicago, Calendar Girls, which is one of those jukebox musicals, this time about Neil Sedaka.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing Evita again. Even little companies that don't ever do musicals at all. Stray Cat Theater is doing a musicalization of the movie Heathers. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, from the 80s, yeah.
Winona Ryder. And,
yeah.
And we have a new theater company called the AC Theater Company, and they are going to do nothing but musicals, sort of little-known or entirely unknown musicals. They have not announced a season yet.
Why do you think that is? I mean, why so many musicals this season?
It's a tough time to sell theater tickets, and musicals sell. The bad news for those of us who go to the theater a lot is we've seen West Side Story. We've seen Evita. Many, many times we've seen Auntie Mame, you know, Hello, Dolly. But theaters have to make a living. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that I take hope in is that the larger theater companies, the professional equity houses, are hooking up with smaller companies like Nearly Naked Theater and Stray Cat Theater and doing what for them is an edgier play each year. And that's a trend I hope to see more of. But we'll never the trend in more musicals than not, that will never go away.
Irrespective of the type of performance that seems to be prevalent this season, do you expect the quality of those shows to be up to the standard that we've seen in the Valley recently?
Sure. I don't know that there's any reason why any company would be doing less estimable work this year than last. I think the question is, what are they going to do with the money that they raise by selling those tickets to a show that they've done before and that we've seen repeatedly in other houses?
So it's a matter of taking that money and sort of reinvesting it, maybe doing something completely different with the revenue that they've got.
Absolutely. Black Theater Troupe is a really good example of that. They are doing the Black Nativity again this year in December, but they're taking the money that they will presumably make from this piece that everybody knows and goes to see because it's a holiday tradition, and they're using it to produce little-known or lesser-known work like these two Frank Higgins plays that they're doing this year. One is called The Taste Test, which is about race identity. And then later in the season, they're doing Black Pearl Sings, which I don't think's ever been produced here. It's sort of loosely based on the career of Leadbelly. And you don't see stuff like that. And I cheer them for taking that money and using it in a way that's kind of progressive.
How long is the cycle from the time that the company makes the money from doing the show that everybody knows to the time that they can take that money and do something that's totally different?
I'm really glad you asked that because obviously Black Theater Troupe, for example, is not going to make money from Black Nativity in December and then in February spend it on something else. But you see my larger point, which is if you're going, you know, Actors Theater of Phoenix did, before they closed up shop, they did A Christmas Carol every year for 19 years. But then they used that money 2 years later to buy plays that none of us had seen before or maybe that most of us hadn't heard of. So, yes, there's a certain amount of time before you can spend the money that you made last Christmas doing Christmas Carol.
Is there the same quantity of performances going on this year as last season?
No, but only because we've lost some companies like Actors Theater, and also because some of the smaller companies have trimmed their seasons just because they can't afford to do maybe seven plays or five plays or whatever their normal roster was.
Robert Pala is theater critic for Phoenix New Times. Robert, thank you as always.
Thanks, Mark.
And that's it for today. If you missed any part of today's program, you can check it out later this afternoon at kjzz.org, or even better yet, you can podcast it on the KJZZ mobile app. If you do not have it, it is entirely free. You should get it. Thank you very much to Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help with today's show. NPR's Here and Now from Boston is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody, in for Steve Goldstein. Thank you so much for listening today. It's 12 noon.